Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal, and may lose value.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And unless the calendar is lying to us, this is the week of Valentine's Day.
That's right.
Yep, which probably means different things to different people. Some may, for some people it may mean, ooh, a celebration of the love that I am now in. For others, it is perhaps a reminder of a past love and brings with it certain negative connotations, or love that is not yet fully manifested in one's life, and then it can be equally problematic. Or maybe it's just, how in the world am I going to get reservations at a restaurant tonight to satisfy the significant other in my life?
That's right.
Yeah,
and I think that we've got a podcast that's going to cater to some of this, right? But we're not talking about
all of it.
Well, yeah. I don't know because we're not talking like roses and kitten farts here, are we?
No, we're not.
We're talking hardcore science and love.
Right. Though it is conceivable that a scientist could study either kitten farts or...
True.
And certainly they study flowers. But yeah, we're dealing with scientists and love. And it's an interesting concept. I mean, it's not out of... Everyone knows scientists are, of course, human beings, and they fall in love. And no matter how nailed down their one part of their life may be with the strict realities of science, they're still subject to this weird human emotion that entangles all of us.
That's right. And we've talked about scientists being the obsessive kind before, right?
Oh, yes.
So it would make sense that scientists in love would be super obsessed, and two scientists in love, doubly so. And their love might be so crazy and strong that it could eventually lead to maybe like the A-bomb.
Yeah, it's like it's like the love is an alcohol, and zeal for science is a caffeinated beverage.
Yes.
And then when those two things mix, when they are in the same container, as we'll see in two cases, when scientists are in love with each other and share that scientific zeal and this love, it becomes something that can potentially give you a heart attack.
It's true.
Yeah.
Right.
In the club.
Right.
As it were.
So specifically, we are talking about
Well, first, let's talk about the Sagans.
That's right, the Sagans.
Yeah.
Carl Sagan and Anne Druyan.
Yes.
Yes. And they had a groovy kind of love.
Yes, a cosmic kind of love, I guess you could say. To set this in time, we are going back to the summer of 1977. And that's when a lot of you probably know Carl Sagan, of course, the host of Cosmos, which you can get on like Netflix streaming and stuff. It's still wonderful today. Most of the science still holds up. But you know, astronomer, astrophysicist, cosmologist, generally was just on the forefront of popularizing science and just being a mascot for scientific inquiry.
Right, particularly space.
Particularly space, yes. And he was involved in a little something called the Voyager Project.
That's right.
And the creative director on this was one Anne Druyan. Now, Voyager, you may remember this mostly from the Star Trek movie, in which a fictional Voyager craft comes back super intelligent. But of course, Voyager, we were sending them out, and they're still sailing out to the limits of man's discovery in space.
That's right.
And aboard this these two particular crafts, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, was a golden record, which interestingly enough, Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich of Radiolab referred to as, quote, the ultimate mixtape.
That's right. Of their love.
Yes.
Because they collaborated on this golden record.
I mean, it's also like a mixtape, like, hey, aliens out there, here you go. And we made a mixtape for you. But that's also, it really represent this bond that was growing between these two, and this love that was growing between these two in the summer of 1977.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally documenting them falling in love and the moment that they fell in love, in which they chose a specific piece of music for it,
mm-hmm.
Which is amazing. And it's just out there flinging itself into outer space.
Yeah, and currently Voyager 1 is 116.5 astronomical units from Earth. Just to rewind, an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So it's that distance spread out 116 and a half times. Voyager 2 is 95.2 astronomical units from the Earth. And these distances continue to increase.
And we talked about this a little bit in our previous podcast about alien etiquette. And the idea, of course, of this golden record is that it would be intercepted and it might tell an extraterrestrial life form what life was like, I suppose you
right.
should say was, during that time
period.
Well,
it could be was. Yeah, because it's going to be out there for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was the joke to us is, well, maybe they intercept this in 400,000 years.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, I don't even know what this chicken scratch is.
Yeah. And it's kind of it's kind of a time capsule as well. But it contained the record contained spoken greetings in 59 different languages, ranging from ancient Akkadian to Wu, a modern Chinese dialect.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to be confused with anything Wu-Tang Clan related.
No.
But sadly, the record was pressed and sent out before their genesis.
Yeah.
But also Sounds of Earth, 90 minutes of selected music from both Eastern and Western classics. Again, no Wu-Tang, sadly. And also The Sound of a Kiss, Mother's First Words to a Newborn Child.
Yeah, a baby crying.
Right.
Yeah, so a vast collection of our human experience.
And most impressive of all, for the purposes of discussing the love between these two scientists, The Sound of a Heartbeat.
That's right. What was the idea? Anne Druyan said, I'd like to have my heartbeat recorded,
mm-hmm.
right? And then sort of data scrambled later to sort of map this out. Take me down that road, Robert.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because Sagan and Anne basically went down and had this recording done like just shortly after they had actually come, because they'd been professionally aligned for a while and they knew each other, they were working each other, but this was after they actually reached the point where they realized they were in love with each
yeah.
other, and just shortly after they'd actually spoken about it with each other, and then they went and recorded her heartbeat, and now it's out there on the plate, and it's beautiful. It's the love and the science intermingling with each other, and you know, maybe it's a little sappy if you're not in the mood for it this week, but for my money,
yeah. But there you go. You've got this incredible collaboration between two people,
mm-hmm.
and we should also note too that Carl Sagan was married at the time that he met Anne Druyan.
Yeah,
and as far as I know, nuts or scandalous went on, so to speak. I think he actually declared his love for her over the phone after she had talked to him about a particular piece of music that they had been obsessing over.
Right.
So it was sort of one of those things that I think that he was like, oh my God, I'm in love with this person. And then, of course, he dissolved his marriage, his first marriage. So I just want to point that out. I think that Carl Sagan was a perfect gentleman. I'd like to think that, but I don't know that for sure.
And of course, Sagan died, sadly, in 96, but Anne continues on, continues yes. writing, and she, I believe, currently resides in New York.
Yep. And she actually made a comment, too, for that Radiolab piece, saying something about how sometimes when she gets a little depressed or, you know, nostalgic, she thinks about the golden record and this document of their love just flung out into outer space, still traveling.
Yeah.
It's kind of a beautiful thought.
I think so as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it's one of those like grand, I mean, he didn't do it for Valentine's Day, but you know, it pretty much, trumps anything that any of us might have might be scheming for that week.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Helicopter ride.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Carl's got you beat.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's another pair, pretty famous pair, that, has come to light recently because of a book that's been written about them.
Right. Though they've been, you know, people have been studying them for a while,
right.
but this latest book has been really, really fascinating.
Sort of reexamining their relationship and their contribution to science.
Yeah, the book is called Radioactive: Marie and Pierre Curie by Lauren Redness. And this just came out, I think, in December of 2010.
Fallish.
Yeah. And we picked up our copies in the last week or two.
Yeah.
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 And this is a book I was really not sure exactly what to expect. And we're going to come back to the Curies, but just to brief, we're going to talk about this book because I basically heard from my wife had heard something about it on the radio, and she's like, "Hey, this sounds like there's a really cool book about the Curies coming out, and the cover glows in the dark." So I'm like,
and that was enough for you.
Well, yeah, I'm like, all right, I'm there. You know, I mean, I love things that glow. I'm wearing a glow in the dark shirt right now.
So, you are,
yeah. And we always record the podcast in complete darkness.
Yeah, well, yeah. Sometimes a candle.
When we have to see the notes. And we only use extremely flammable paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
But anyway, this book, so I get it in, right? And it's, you know, it's a large, hardbound book. And sure enough, the cover glows in the dark. But it's kind of hard to describe because it's not really, one might be tempted to talk about it as a graphic novel.
But right, that was my initial impression.
But generally speaking, graphic novels are more a case of sequential art, where you're mm-hmm. having little boxes or large boxes of images that tell a story.
Right.
And this is more, I guess I would tend to think of this as like an illuminated manuscript or just an illustrated biography, but it's not even calling it a biography is not really accurate.
No, in fact, I heard an interview on NPR with the author Laura Redness, mm-hmm. and the interviewer had actually made this observation that he thought that it was more like sort of an illuminated manuscript or journal, mm-hmm. like this imagined journal.
Yeah, they're
of what might be Marie and Pierre Curie's experiences.
Yeah, it's kind of scrapbooky, and I say that in like the absolute best connotation.
Yeah, like we're not talking Etsy here. We're talking science scrapbooky, if that makes any sense. But the reason that we're getting so excited about this is because Laura Redness really put a tremendous amount of research into this book.
Right.
So she's looking at the trajectory of Marie and Pierre Curie's relationship, which is really the heart of this book and is interesting in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But she's also looking at what their discoveries bore out for us as humanity. And she's also looking at the future generations of the Curies and what they contribute or what their contributions were as well. So, I mean, she went to great lengths really to mine a lot of information of this book.
Right. Now, I think we should stop for a second, just for anybody listening out there who's not really familiar with the Curies or needs a refresher. Marie Curie was born Marie Skłodowska.
Sounds good.
Yep. In Warsaw, Poland, back in 1876, I believe.
Yes.
And she went on to marry physics professor Pierre Curie in 1894, and the two dove into research together. Like this is again, it's like the deal with Carl and Anne. They were both just really into their work, and suddenly they had the chance to be together and they fell in love, and they threw themselves at the same research.
Right. And actually, let's just go with that, because I think it's interesting to point out that Marie Curie, who is originally Maria, she changed her name to Marie, when she was in Paris, but she was one of very few, obviously, women, students at Sorbonne. And she was the first to get her PhD in science.
And I believe the first to become a professor there?
Yes. Yes. And, she was appointed after her husband's death.
And she won not one, but two Nobel Prizes.
Yeah. So first woman to win a Nobel Prize, first person to win two.
Yeah.
Alongside Pierre. So the reason why I think that's important is because these are incredible circumstances for this woman to be in. And the fact of the matter is she met Pierre because she just needed some extra lab space. So someone was like, oh, you should check out this guy. He's got some extra space. You know, you could probably use it. So what happens, obviously, is they come together and they find that they are both the most hardcore science researchers that they know that exist. And that really bonds them. So they have this, I don't know that I would call it a passionate sort of love. I don't know that we know that. Mm-hmm. But we know that they're passionate about their research, and this really bonds them together.
Right. Yeah. They become like a team effort, you know, and what did they accomplish? Well, okay, the first Nobel Prize had to do with her with their isolation of polonium,
right,
which is a radioactive element named by Marie for Poland, her home country.
That's right,
and also radium, another radioactive element, and the one that was far more noteworthy, and we discussed a little more. And she named that one. That has the Latin for light, I believe.
Yep. And then the second one was for actually her inquiry into radioactivity, the fact that she even discovered that their elements could be radioactive.
Right.
Right.
So this book is about these two people coming together, about the thoroughly non-scientific things in their lives that led them to each other. Like she fell in love with a noble and son, as I remember. And,
right.
And he was too good for her, according to the family, so it was heartbreak.
That's right.
And then he had another situation where he was in love with someone, and it just was not meant to be, you know.
Right, so they had both experienced heartache.
Yeah.
And when they found each other, I think they are obviously drawn to each other because of their love of science. But Marie also says, as told by Laura Redness in the book, he caught the habit of speaking to me in his dream of an existence consecrated entirely to scientific research and asked me to share that life.
Yeah.
So that, again, is unusual to have this pair of people at that time period saying, okay, let's just throw all caution to the wind. We'll get married. We'll research like we've never researched in our life. Maybe we'll have kids. The kids don't matter in the sense that you'll still research.
And then they'll research too.
That's right.
We'll create the
little researchers. And so again, that was not something that was commonly thought then. It was you get married, you raise the children. You know, I'll come home and you make me some, you know, roast beef.
Right. And she was still doing that, and she was doing the science. I mean, she was going to the lab with him and working, but also raising kids, cooking. So the great thing about Redness's book, I mean, aside from just being beautiful to look through, I mean, the illustrations are magnificent, is that she weaves the emerging love of the Curies with the emergence of this science, of this fascinating science of radioactivity.
Right. 'Cause radium and polonium by themselves is kind of like, okay, yeah, all right. So there's the elements, but what does that mean to our society today?
Well, a tremendous amount. And at the time, you really had this, especially with radium, there was this radium zeal that really took off. And Redness discusses this at length in the book. And because it was a time, it's like, think back to any time where we've developed a new technology. Like when electricity was first, becoming a thing, and the utilization of electricity in our lives, like people were tremendously excited about it, you know,
right.
Tesla and Edison are doing all this stuff. It's like, let's show it off. Let's do it. Let's electrocute an elephant.
Right. Tesla's electrocuting himself.
Yeah. Like electrocuting himself. There was some fascinating talk in the time where people were discussing using electricity to execute criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And some people were actually speaking up and saying, this is blasphemous because mm-hmm. electricity is this holy, blameless creature. And,
right.
And you can't use that to kill a criminal. That's horrible.
Yeah.
You know?
How can it light up my life and allow me to stay up late and kill a criminal?
It's just completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So, you see, and we end up seeing the same thing with radium. Today, you continue to see, anytime there's like any kind of new science, you can guarantee somebody out there is going to try and market something to make a buck off of it. And with radium at the time, it was really kind of crazy.
And we should also point out that the reason that this happened, that radium sort of went nuts, is that Marie and Pierre Curie decided not to patent radium because they thought, well, no, I mean, you know, it's only going to be a handful of scientists that really need to use it. We don't need to patent it.
Yeah, and they were like, this is a totally beneficial thing. A lot of great stuff is going to come out of this.
Yeah,
and it just wouldn't be in the spirit of what we're doing.
Right.
So, along come the all these radioactive quack cures. Just to run through a few, like there were a lot of radium water jars where you just filled up with water and then you could have radium in your drinking water.
Why
radioactive
not?
Drinking water. Seemed like a good idea at the time, right? There were other far more questionable items such as suppositories.
Again, we're talking about real radium in the suppository, right?
Right? Yeah. Mm. Actual radioactive elements in a person's rectum for medicinal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You could get radioactive toothpaste. Again, it's just, you could get these radioactive plates to put in your cigarette, package.
Right.
Cigarette, at the time, it's like if you thought, oh, these cigarettes aren't good enough for me now, yeah, no, let me add some radioactivity to that just to boost the health factor a little. There were, refrigerator freezer deodorizers. You could get a flask.
So you could radiate all your food in the freezer. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it just went on and on. And then on top of that, at the time, again, everybody's willing to rate. Radium was, A, expensive.
Right.
And all this hope was wrapped up in it. This stuff's going to change the world. And so for a brief time, before the dark attributes of radium became fully known, it became like if you had had a credit card.
Right.
Back in the early 1900s. Platinum or gold, neither of those would have been your higher, in card. No, you would want a radium card because you had a number of these different radium branded products that were not in and of themselves radioactive, but you had like radium beer, you had radium Nut-X condoms, you had radium playing cards, radium cigarettes. The list just goes on.
So this is like when I see products in the store and it says all natural or organic, and they actually, that's sort of like the greenwashing. They may not be.
Yeah, this is like radium washing.
Wow. So that was a crazy amount of fervor around something like that.
Yeah, and of course it was not meant to last.
No.
And that's one of the, again, something that's beautifully woven into this text because. It does parallel so often our stories of love, where love blooms and is awesome, but then there either love falters or it is complicated by other things,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it doesn't fail, but it is forced to become a more realistic beast, you know?
The half-life, it stabilizes.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. Nice. So, what I think is interesting about this too is that, you know, obviously Pierre and Marie didn't really understand how dangerous it was to be handling this in the first place anyway.
And boy, were they handling it.
Yeah. I mean, they were tossing it around at dinner parties, right?
Yeah.
Marie had a little bar in a jar next to her bed that mm-hmm. would, you know, illuminate blue at night, which I'm sure was quite pretty.
And then there's also this case too where it was 1903. And Pierre goes into the United Kingdom's Royal Institution, and there are all these guys there, scientists from all over, and he rolls up his sleeve to show a burn on his arm, or what looks like a burn, off to everybody. And this is a wound that had been caused by radium salts, which he had taped to the skin for just 10 hours 50 days earlier,
mm-hmm.
and the wound was still there. And then while he's doing this, he ends up spilling some of the salts that he's showing off onto the table, and the resulting contamination of the table was still detectable and in need of cleaning up like 50 years later. So, and you know, when we're saying it, the way we're presenting it, it probably it comes off a little weird and a little bizarre and maybe a little funny. But the way Redness presents it, I mean, she presents these two human beings
mm-hmm.
and that are engaged in this thing they really care about and are engaged in this relationship, and they keep they keep dealing with this dangerous stuff, and they're getting more and more sick. It's having an effect on their bodies and their well-being, and they realize it on some level, but she's still sleeping next to
them.
They can't stop themselves.
Yeah.
Like I was telling you earlier, it reminds me of stories you hear about people that are in an abusive relationship, mm-hmm. and they know that it's a bad relationship, but they can't break themselves away from it because they're tied to it, they're obsessed with it. And that's the way, Redness really presents it here, you
right.
know, that they're so obsessed with this scientific discovery that they're working with that they can't separate themselves enough from it to save themselves.
Well, and I think it's because it's that quest for knowledge. They
yeah.
know there's more potential than they realize. And in fact, they,
and there is, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they start to say, okay, well, if this is killing healthy cells, maybe it can kill diseased cells and mm-hmm. therefore it could be used in radiation.
Right.
So
and this is after they had worked with, they figured out ways that what would become x-rays.
Right.
Where it can be used to figure out you don't have to cut into a limb to see what's going on with the bones. We it's easy to overlook that today, just how helpful.
Right.
An x-ray is.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, you've got these two people completely obsessed with this, completely obsessed with the process. And, you know, Redness does do a great job of weaving what becomes that story of radiation, right? So what happens is that, you know, they're playing around with it. They have a couple of daughters, Irene and Eve. Mm-hmm. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit because there's awful lot of stuff that happens in Marie and Pierre Curie's life. But what happens is that Irene begins to study radium as well.
Mm-hmm.
And marries a scientist, Frederic, and they actually create artificial radioactivity, which is to say that they can take an element and make it radioactive.
Right.
And then you begin to see that this is information that's being relayed from one generation to another, and it makes me think about our past podcasts about tool users and even about computer viruses, where we talk about how the human is just essentially a host for information,
uh-huh.
host for technology, and that they're just replicating it based on us. And that really is evident, I think, in this connection between the generations here.
Right. And also, like we were talking about that, the optimism for radium and all things radioactive, that optimism beginning to fall for a little and definitely become a lot more realistic.
Yeah.
And part of that was realizing, whoa, the Curies are getting really ill.
Right.
But also when people were suddenly realizing, hey, we can make weapons out of this. Not only are there certain, negative health, things going on here, but we could make a bomb.
Yeah, that's right. And it's Einstein, actually, who's looking at the situation and looking at the discoveries of the two generations and sends out a missive to FDR saying, hey, we probably need to get behind
yeah,
this.
Yeah, because the Germans are working on it.
Yeah. So, again, it's like this very interesting trajectory between, like, the relationships and how the relationships are bearing out science.
Right.
Which, you know, implicates all of us, really, when you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, the book also goes a lot into, like, it'll deal with the Curies. And then it'll flash forward to Robert Oppenheimer,
mm-hmm.
Contemplating nuclear weapons, or it will skip to Hiroshima or Three Mile Island, and then it'll skip back to the Curies. So it jumps around in time a little
mm-hmm.
and gives you this complete picture of what they're working on and what it's ultimately going to become. The atomic tests in Nevada. And the,
mm-hmm.
I was not aware before reading this that anyone ever had a mushroom cloud party where you would go out and have like a barbecue and,
yeah,
and see the distant,
yeah.
I mean, not close up, but like the distant, smoke rising.
Yeah, apparently in Las Vegas, this was a big deal, right?
And yeah.
the whatever the years between 1945 and 1963 that you would have a mushroom cloud party, I guess until they went underground.
Yeah.
And started detonating there. But, yeah, you see that picture. You see you see radium sort of being born
mm-hmm.
and being teased into this other thing that becomes the A-bomb.
Yeah.
Just as you see Irene being born and having this relationship and furthering that technology and then having she and her husband having another child, which is the grandchild of Marie, who becomes a nuclear physicist.
Right.
Of course, you know, the book does, as you say, jump around, but you keep going back to that story of Marie specifically sort of suffering for her knowledge in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at how she and Pierre detailed the accounts of their own decline Marie more so, because Pierre was killed. He had an untimely death. He was killed in 1906, I believe.
Yeah,
he was run over by a carriage carrying 13,000 tons of military gear.
Yeah, that was a brutal part.
Yeah. But Marie, at the end of her life, when she was very, very sick, and she died from aplastic anemia, which was, of course, caused by the radiation, she chronicled her deterioration in data columns with entries on her body temperature, her color, her urine discharged in pus, and she tracked her level of pain. I mean, it's just so interesting that even at the very end of her life that she's sort of handling it the only way that she knows how to, which is to make it into data that she can try to understand.
Right.
But, you know, that's the interesting thing about this, is it's this slow death of herself, and even Irene and Frederic, her daughter and son-in-law, are exposed to radiation and also getting ill as well.
Yeah. It's a really powerful book. I actually read the second half of it last night before going to sleep. And so I had all these dreams where somebody was testing nuclear weapons, on a college campus. And I was getting like really, cause they were doing like some sort of, in the dream, they were doing some sort of, like war game. And I just was so angry. I was like, why are you doing this? This is so destructive to all of us. And
don't you know that now I'm going to have to deal with the zombies after the apocalypse and retreat to a mall now?
I know. Well, luckily the zombies didn't show up in the dream. But
that's good.
Yeah.
I think, though, again, looking back at their accomplishments, you just have to look at how amazing it is that they took 4 years of their lives just specifically for radium. It's grueling work. They are in a shed in Paris. They had 40 tons of corrosive materials to go through to extract just 1/10 of a gram of radium. And the reason they had to do that is because they had to prove that it physically existed. Because just to say, you know, okay, well, we found this, and to try to get this published, the scientific community wasn't necessarily going to take that at face value.
Right.
So they think about all that exposure in that time going through a heat pile. Yeah. Corrosive materials. Kind of creepy.
So anyway, it's we're not being bribed to say this, but it's a great book. So if you if you're interested in an atypical science book, pick it up. If you want to read a romance that has science in it, and also a story of scientific advancement and all the complications that come with it in human culture, it's a really good read.
Yeah.
Also, would make for a pretty cool Valentine's Day gift if that other person in your life is interested in science at all.
And I would say even it sort of extends beyond that. I mean, it's about humanity, right?
Yeah, it's bigger than just a mere romance.
Yeah, and I don't mean to get all goofy here, but I admit that I had like a tear.
Yeah.
At my kitchen table, and it wasn't the love story part of it. I was just like, wow, she did a great job in really capturing what science means to us. I think on an individual level.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a great book.
All right, enough with my earnest exclamations. Robert, take us on home.
Okay. Well, I believe we have a little listener mail here.
Okay.
We have one here from a listener by the name of Peter, and he writes in, Julie and Robert, regarding the Future of Pain podcast. First of all, what is an Indian burn? I grew up with three boisterous brothers, and I'm sure that we tortured each other in various ways, but I've never heard of this particular infliction of pain. Do you want to answer that, what an Indian burn is?
It's when you take someone's arm, for instance, and you put both of your hands on, and then you twist in opposite directions until, this is my understanding of it. Other people may have other variations. But you do it
this
so that
you... This is the Julie method.
This is my brother method, until your skin becomes raw and hurts a lot.
Okay. All right. So anyway, Peter, there you go.
And I don't know the etymology of it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually Native American or Ayurvedic in its origins.
No.
Peter continues. However, my bigger question is whether this is an appropriate. Oh no, he goes on to ask about the racial and ethical references. Sorry. So there you go. That's our answer too. It probably doesn't. But his main point is, I want to come back to the new anesthetic technique called continuous peripheral nerve block. In 2009. I was in a truly horrific head-on car crash caused by a drunk driver, resulting in severe trauma and burns. I was hospitalized for 5 months, and I am truly grateful for pain management with opiates. These drugs certainly made me somewhat loopy and confused, but I wouldn't call it a high. Even so, these side effects may have been beneficial. In retrospect, I think that it was helpful to only gradually become conscious and cognizant of my permanent injuries. If my physical discomfort had been controlled in such a way that my thoughts were clear and present, I think that I would have been pained and traumatized in other ways. It was difficult enough to accept my missing fingers and toes, large areas of grafted skin, and generally shattered existence. In addition, I was essentially immobilized on my back for 3 months, and the narcotic effect of Oxycontin and other medications certainly made this miserable time more tolerable. Fortunately, as I have continued to recover, I am not in any constant pain or even in any significant intermittent pain. I have learned to walk again. I am composing this message with voice recognition software, and I am working half-time in my profession. I do have some long-term side effects from the extended period on opiates, such as chronic difficulty sleeping, but no addictions. Opiates were definitely worth it. I'm a regular listener. Thanks for the great podcast. So, Peter, thanks for writing in. That was the nerve blocking technique was something we discussed, as well as the use of opiates. So it's really nice to have some listener feedback on how this actually affects one's life.
Yeah, and we're glad that you're doing well as well. So, indeed. Yeah, thank you for listening.
So, hey, if you have anything that you would like to share with us, one place you can find us is Facebook. The other is Twitter. On both of those, we are Below the Mind.
And, hey, I actually have a correction within this podcast right now, right here, and that is that I have been referring to Lauren Redness as Laura. So, Lauren, my apologies. And if you'd like to email us, please do so at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.